Take that one.
Line unmuted.
Need to reset the supplemental meeting. Get a moment of silence for the all the police and fire that have passed, and for all the people down in Kerr County.
I have an amendment to the small amendments to both of the minutes.
Okay.
Before you approve the minutes, I would like to make an amendment to reflect that David Kelly was here at the time of the roll call. We had him being 1 minute late, which is incorrect. So on both of them, I'd like to make that amendment.
So, Kelly, if I'm ever here late, it's going to be really late. You'll know. Thank you.
Okay, so we get a motion to approve the minutes of the June 12th for our public meeting.
So moved.
Get a second.
Second. All I meant to give the second, but I was late.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Motion approved. And a motion to approve the minutes of the June 12th regular meeting.
So moved.
Second.
A second.
Seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, signify by saying nay. Motion passes. Any public comments? You're on the phone, 5-star. I think we have one individual. Public comments.
No. Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me speak. It's mostly positive stuff, but I did want to cover some things before the board meeting gets started. I want to take the time to thank Kelly and your staff for the good work you all do, dedication, and the great service, and take care of our fund. Appreciate the staff and your executive staff and the full staff. I want to congratulate Michael Tagliente for becoming getting elected chairman, Mr. Toll, vice chairman. Thank the active police and fire trustees for their service, too. I know that they've earned the respect and the confidence of the active police and fire to get elected as trustees. So thank you, Matthew, Mike Tagliente. I want to thank the mayor appointees because I know that y'all take a lot of time. It takes a lot of dedication to this extension of community service. Thank you for taking that appointee by the mayor. And I know all of y'all have great resumes, but thank you for your service and the governance and the advice and with your resumes, that great investment advice and legal advice that y'all gave our fund. I want to give a special shout out to the at-large trustees, Tony Scavuzzo, and Nick Scavuzzo, right?
It's
Tony Scavuzzo, I'm sorry, and Marcus Smith. That is a big deal because y'all get, I know our active trustees get only voted on by the active police and fire, but Tony, you and Marcus get voted on by active police and fire and our retirees, police and fire. So that is a big deal. So I want to thank you for your service. Tony, I know that you got some ties at Chicago, police and fire, and your family. I'm glad, though, you're living in Dallas now. So made a good move there. And Marcus, thank you for coming in from Houston every month. I know that takes time from your away from your family, so thank you for your dedication and service coming in from Houston every month. And Marcus also is the second partner in Garcia Hamilton to have served on our board, and he's given away to a third partner. First is Gilbert Garcia, Marcus Smith, and now Yvette Duenas is going to be the third partner with Garcia Hamilton to serve on our board. So the other thing I wanted to discuss was the at some point, hopefully we'll get an answer or get it resolved, but it's starting to really bother me about this, the ADC in regards to the city, the actuarial determined contribution. I know that in the footnotes of the financials, prior to 2015, they're not in there anymore, but from 2015 to current, it appears that, you know, I look at the city and I say, you know, it's the eighth largest city in the country. But I don't think they act like the eighth largest city in the country because they can't even honor the commitments and the promises they made to police and fire. If they had properly funded the ADC since 2015, with those footnotes being in those financials, this fund would have an additional $500 million. And I'm sure that Ryan Wagner would love to have had another $500 million to invest in this fund. And then with y'all's ability on your advice, governance, oversight, we probably would have had some great returns if we had had that additional $500 million if the city had properly funded the ADC since 2015. So the other thing I want to bring up is, how is it possible, hopefully I'll get an answer, there's a lot of smart people here in the room, but how is it that the eighth largest city in the world, in the country, I'm sorry, has one of the most highly respected police departments and fire departments, and yet it is secondary, however way you want to look at it, it's last, secondary, or second to the civilian fund. They have a better benefit structure than we have now. They have an annual adjustment. Our guys make calls 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They always take that call. They always answer. I'm not against the civilian employees. I'm not trying to bash them. But they're 8 to 5 people. So they got 15 hours off every day. They're not going to answer the call before 8 o'clock. They're not going to answer the call after 5 o'clock. They're not going to answer calls on weekends, city holidays, national holidays. They're there with their family. You're not going to be able to reach those people. So, you know, they're getting better benefit structure and annual adjustment, but yet at best they give 9 hours a day to the city. So they're not there a good 100 days out of the year answering calls. I don't know how that works, but the other part of that, not having that annual adjustment. I talked to somebody that's an expert in the financial services, and I asked them, hey, since we haven't had an annual adjustment since 2017, how much is my dollar in 2017 worth today? It says 65 cents. So I've taken a 35% haircut. Not just me. I put in 36 years with Dallas Fire Rescue. My wife put in 24 years with Dallas Fire Rescue. So every active guy, police and fire, that's looking to retire, that's what they're going to be facing. Every retiree has been facing it for 8 years, a 35% haircut. So hopefully that gets addressed. Maybe y'all give me an answer. Smart people in this room. You know, I grew up in Dallas, born in 1955. I grew up in a little neighborhood just west there of Love Field, Harry Hines and Roanoke Avenue, not too far from here. Called the poor side of, on the west side of Love Field, poor side of town. But I went to public schools here locally, elementary school, junior high, high school. I was fortunate to graduate from college at a university there in Highland Park, Texas. Memory serves me right, I think it was called Southern Methodist University, or SMU. So go ponies. But if somebody can give me an answer to some of that stuff, I'd appreciate it. I don't know if y'all can even respond, but primarily I just want to say thank you to this board, the trustees, staff, for everything you do, your dedicated service, and God bless y'all for taking care of our fund. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your comments.
No, he's doing something wrong. Okay, so the first item that we have is certification of the non-member trustee election results. And as you know, the statute requires that the nominations committee, which both of the gentlemen in the audience are part of, determine a process and select a slate of candidates. And then we hold an election. We do that pursuant to the rules adopted by the board. It's an outside election company. Same company we've used for years to make it very seamless. We held that election. The voting ended June 30th, and all three candidates on the slate were elected by more than 80% of the vote. They only needed 50% yes votes, so we don't need to have a runoff election. We had a 10% turnout rate. Of that, though, the retirees made up the largest proportion, 7% of the retirees voted, well, 6% of the actives voted. So with that, with the election results, Yvette Dunez, Ina Hernandez-Patterson, and Tony Scabuzzo have all been elected to serve their next term, which starts September 1st, 2025, and ends August 31st, 2028. So if you don't have any questions about that, we need a motion to certify the election results.
So moved. Second.
Okay, all in favor of certifying the election? Yvette Duane? Aye. Tina?
Aye.
Peterson?
Was that?
He said aye.
Oh, okay. Andy Scabuzzo and Tina Anthony. My member trustees serve from September 1st, 2025 until August 31st, 2028. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. Board committee appointments. So, I would like to, we have some open spots on our audit committee. And I would like to appoint Joe Colanetta to the audit committee and name Tony Scabuzzo as the chair of the audit committee. So can I get a motion to appoint Joe Colanetta?
Before the motion, can I just, for the new members, so I included in the materials the policy on the committees just for your review, but just so you know, the two committees that we're talking about here are the audit committee and the professional services committee. The IAC, you know, is that structure comes out of the investment policy, and you appointed those last month. The policy requires that there be at least one mayoral appointee on each of those two committees, and at least one of the either the police, fire, or the non-members on there, and then at least one other person. There can be more, but that's kind of the structure. And the policy also says that the chair nominates the members, and then the board can do whatever you'd like with that nomination. So that's the structure.
I'd like to have some discussion on this matter for a moment.
Sure.
Tony, how many fingers am I holding up? You're good. Joe? I'm good.
Just on the Professional Services Committee, I want to wait until we have the trustees in place before we nominate anyone there. So I get a motion to appoint Joe Colanetta to the audit committee and to name Tony Scabuzzo as the chair of the audit committee.
So moved.
Okay, a second?
Second.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay, none. The motion passes.
Does that have to like for the space income?
Financial horrible.
Thank you. The field work for the audit is continuing. About over 90% of the auditor requests have been completed and returned to them. The items that are outstanding primarily relate to the actuary report and some investments. The valuation memos for HUF and Lone Star are almost finished, and once those are finished, then the financials can be finalized. Once the financials are finalized, then we'll send that information to Siegel, our actuary, and they'll begin work, or they'll continue the work that they've already started on the experience study. Following the experience study will then come the actuary report, the audited financials, and the ACFR, the annual financial report. So we're well on our way. We think in the next few months you'll begin to see a report every month as we complete these various reports. We're still working, we're already working on the financial statements and the annual, the act first that we'll have ready for you guys to review in the next couple of months. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
to add a little bit to that, we're hopeful that next month at the August meeting that Jeff Williams from Siegel will be here to talk about the results of the experience study. And that I think is an interesting conversation usually, at least for me, with the actuary. And then that will drive the valuation and the city's contribution going forward. That should be an interesting conversation.
What day is our August meeting?
August 14th.
14th.
The next item is a contribution update. This is the same report that I provide every month. Through June 17th, the shortfall between the city's plan and what the city's paying is $9.8 million. That combined with the $3 million from the prior fiscal year shows a shortfall of $12.8 million. No surprise there. Are there any questions? Okay. The next item is the ministerial actions. The only item I wanted to point out on this item is the last row in the table is called earnings test, and you'll only see numbers in there this time of year. Sometimes it actually spans 2 months, but you'll see. And what that is we've got 11 people with disabilities that are subject to an annual earnings test. And if they make too much money from an outside employment, we have to reduce their pension benefit. And this year we have to reduce one person's pension benefit. This is a person that, since they have been on disability, every other year we have to reduce their pension benefit. So it's not a surprise to the person. Just something we go through. Any questions about this item? Okay. Thank you. Sasha has provided for you a list of some upcoming TechFirst and MCFirst training classes. The approvals for the attendance for some of these conferences, you've already taken care of at prior meetings. Is there anybody else that wants to attend any of the MCFIRS programs or the TechFirst that are listed here to get approved this meeting?
I don't know if the city will allow me to go, so working with them on that with El Paso, I'd like this is tentatively if the city.
So I would suggest we go ahead and approve that here, and then if that works out, we can.
Matt, what's the nature of the prescription? Why won't they allow you to go? It's a great question. They do not feel like this is city business.
You went last month, last time, Austin.
For a vacation time.
Oh,
wow.
Shit, really?
Mm.
Yeah. He's a very important person. The fire department can't really work without him.
Police department.
Yeah, they don't
use it differently. Fire department does not use this as an official city.
They're annoyed when I show up. He's a captain. Yeah. Face kind of collapses at him there. So
that doesn't seem pretty smart.
What do we need to get the PFA involved again?
We'll see. Well, there's a lot of politics involved. So you know what?
Needed to that rectified.
I would like to go if I can get the time.
Yes.
So we'll see how it goes.
We need a motion to approve travel funding for. If he can,
I'll move.
For Matt Chum.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Okay. Now, this next item is something that I'm not sure some of you have seen before. Luckily, we don't have it very often, but the board adopted a policy which is consistent with state law and actually IRS code related to corrections of errors and benefit payments. And luckily, we don't have a lot of these. But our policy basically says when we discover an error, whether it's an underpayment or an overpayment in a pension benefit that is more than $10,000, I need to alert you all. I mean, that's so, you know, obvious reasons. You have some idea of what's going on, you know, if you need to be concerned about anything. We recently discovered an underpayment error. This error impacted one individual. Unfortunate, but an underpayment, you know, better than an overpayment because I'm required to get the money back. The policy goes through basically I need to notify the board, which I'm doing right now. I need to let you know what happened, which I'll let you know what happened and kind of what we've done to resolve it and any future actions we're taking. So the situation with this particular person is what happens when an individual passes away, a member passes away. If there are qualified survivors, which could be a qualified spouse, somebody they were married to before they left, and qualified children, which are typically, unless they're disabled, children under 19, they will split the member's benefit, and the spouse will get 50%, and the children will get 50% of the benefit. Typically, when the children age out, the spouse just continues to get their 50%. However, in 2023, we passed legislation that changed those rules for line-of-duty death situations. This particular underpayment relates to a member who died in the line of duty. And when a member dies in the line of duty, the family unit, whether that's there's only a spouse or only kids or family and, you know, spouse and kids, should get 100% of the benefit. So what we should have done when those children aged out at the age of 19, we should have increased the spouse's. We should have eliminated the child's benefit, but we should have increased the spouse's benefit to 100%. We didn't do that. And part of the reason this fell through the crack was we like to notify people that their benefit is going away early so they can plan for it. This person actually aged out in October of 2023. The law came into effect September of 2023. Our benefits counselor prepared the information to take the child off in August. So basically, when she filled out the form, the Excel spreadsheet, which we have to do by hand, she wasn't thinking about, well, we just passed this bill, and it was August. So she filled out the worksheet. When we processed it, it was after October, and we should have caught it. There's a manual check in the system that says line of duty death. We missed that. The worksheet we changed after September to have a flag on there that we'll catch the line of duty. But all this is manual. The system doesn't help in any way. We missed that. And then in the review process, we missed it. So there was really, I think, three pieces that we could have alerted us, and we just missed it. We've gone back through. More than a year, we've actually had a second reviewer in the process, an executive reviews the child turning 19. So that should help. We've changed the worksheet, so that should help, but it's in there. We've checked everybody else that's in that situation. There are no other errors like this. We found this error came about when we were actually looking at a different query. Had nothing to do with this. It just came up because we were looking at bifurcated benefits and minimum payments, that type of thing. It just happened to come up, and the counselor looking at that said, hey, this doesn't look right. So she just randomly caught it. It was kind of a random error, but we will be paying this person the back payment that they would have had since October 2023, which is $43,000, and interest on that of about $2,300, and then it'll be taken care of, and we'll be more cognizant. It's one of the reasons it will be good when we get our new pension administration software. We won't have to, we won't hopefully have as many of these human errors system on. Are there questions about this situation? Thank you.
One question, Kelly. How, what is our protocol, and how confident are we that we don't have a lot of underpayment, overpayments and underpayments? Is it, I mean, do we have guardrails on that? I'm just reminded of some of our federal programs that seem to either pervasively underpay or overpay and aren't well that well run. And how do we compare our processes?
We do a lot of double checking, and even when we actually worked with the outside consultants to look at our process, they were saying, you all don't trust your system, do you, because you have so many people checking. So, for example, if somebody dies or when a retirement happens or they join drop, the process is a counselor fills out the worksheet, and then that information goes to the quality control person. We have a person that's all she does is review things. And then that information goes to an executive to review again. And then that information gets entered into the system, which then gets in checked again by a quality control person. And the system should actually, when the information gets entered, comes up with some of these calculations itself, and sometimes they match and sometimes they don't. And if they don't match, then we try to figure out why. So So we're doing everything we can, but there is a lot of double checking and manual work in here. I'm not aware of any underpayments or overpayments that we have because we have to fix them when we get them. And they don't come up very often. That's why you don't see these very often, luckily. But unfortunately, they do happen. We've got a 400, and I made this checklist because we were having our death process is very complicated. So I started to do a checklist for the counselors on do this, do this, do this. There are over 400 lines on this checklist that you have to go through and check these 400 things to calculate a death correctly. And that's what we do because it's complicated and we have to do it. The biggest problem that we have, and every pension system has this, is you have to catch things on the front end. Because once you set them up, you don't really look at them again unless something brings it to your attention. You know, we've got 5,000 people that are getting paid every month, and there's no reason to go in and look at them. So hopefully there's no underpayments or overpayments out there. There may be. You know, we do periodic checks of, let's look at everybody's minimum payments. Let's look at all the bifurcated payments. Let's look at everybody over 55 that are special services. So we'll do random kind of queries and look to make sure everything looks okay, but it's tough to catch them once they're set up.
Thanks.
New system will help, for sure.
Is the new system like AI-based? Because it seems like AI would sort of catch a lot of stuff.
It's not. At this point, it
really
would be. Maybe AI could be used to validate different things. I mean, we're talking about AI for other reasons internally. I mean, the thing with AI is we would have to contain the information internally because certainly we can't have our member data out.
True,
correct. There's definitely some things we could do in the future.
How are you notified when somebody dies?
How are we notified? So a lot of times we hear from a family member or we'll hear from the police or fire departments. We hear from the retiree associations. Luckily, the police and fire world is, you know, a close-knit group. So usually a friend or relative or the city tells us. That's not true on the employee side. You know, a lot of those, they're not as close-knit. And then we also have two services that we use that we run reports every week and one every month to see if there's any matches from the Social Security database that come up.
Okay, so somebody can't be deceased for 6 months still getting a payment.
The other, sometimes people will pass away and we don't know about it, and their direct deposit will bounce back because their checking account's closed. So that's another way we find out. Any other questions? Thank you. Okay. We have a hardship item. These are not my favorite. And I put together a little PowerPoint on this item, which I don't normally do. But what I'm doing on this hardship is different than I've ever done before. Is typically what we do is somebody will request a hardship. We look at what the hardship is for, and if it doesn't meet the criteria and it's clear, we let the person know it doesn't meet the criteria, and usually that, you know, that's fine. If it does meet or it's marginal, then we go through a very exhaustive ruling financial analysis. We have a hardship right now request that I've indicated to the person I don't think meets the criteria that the board has approved in the past. But I would bring it to you. And I'm bringing this to you now so you can consider whether you think this criteria is going to be acceptable. And if you think it is, then we'll go the next step and do the financial piece. But I didn't want to put the member through that process if we weren't going to approve it anyway. So just so you know, the statute says that we can do hardships for drop payments for unforeseen events. And then the board adopted a policy in 2017 that really defined how that will work and what we can do hardships for. So I've gone through a little bit of that so you can see if you feel like this is something you want to consider. Some of these items in prior boards, they have not been willing to grant a hardship on, but I recognize this is a new group of people. So just to summarize the hardship is, you know, basically it needs to be for something that was not reasonably foreseeable. The hardship needs to exist at the time of the application. The hardship can't be relieved through other financial means, including insurance or actually other financing. And the amount of the request needs to relate to the amount of the hardship, can't be more than that. Kind of summary. This is all taken out of the policy, which I'm going to use the full policy. The board has recognized things that you thought would be acceptable for the hardship. And when the board adopted this policy in 2017, they went and they looked at hardships for like defined contribution plans and kind of modeled it after that. So some of the acceptable items would be need to repair, damaged to a primary residence, not covered by insurance, as a result of a natural disaster or significant event, such as a fire or flood, that type of thing. Need to make improvements to the primary residence for medical necessity. Need to pay medical expenses for a drop annuitant, a spouse, a dependent child, not covered by insurance. The next page is need to pay for funeral expenses. He is have the drop estate pay for the medical expenses for a member that has passed away. And then F is kind of the catch-all, that which is where this would fall. Other similar extraordinary and unforeseeable circumstances arising as a result of an event beyond the control of a drop in. So what I have is some information that's clear from this member, and some of the information is still a little bit fuzzy. I did give them the opportunity to provide more information, which is why I didn't have a recommendation on the discussion sheet, and I didn't receive anything. So basically, the situation is there are four court cases related to credit card debt, three with Bank of America and one with J.P. Morgan. That's $67,000 of it. And then there's two items, one which he didn't provide documentation on, and one which wasn't clear what it was, but he has indicated they were medical bills related to a 2020 car accident. The event needs to, according to your policy, needs to have occurred within 6 months of the hardship request. I think that's a little restrictive, so if that has been something I've asked the board to waive in the past. But basically, that's another $5,700 related to potentially unpaid medical bills. But it's not just the bills. They weren't paid, and now these are court cases as well. And then there was an air conditioning unit that was replaced. The unit was 15 years old. They have financed it, and they're paying $40 a month for 15 years to pay for that. So in the past, there was conversation that, I think actually when the policy was first adopted, we talked about, well, what if somebody doesn't pay their mortgage and their house is in foreclosure? The board at that time thought that wouldn't qualify because that was foreseeable and in the person's control. The credit card debt, you might think, falls in that same realm. The air conditioning unit, we've had those situations in the past. The board has decided, you know, house stuff fails, that's foreseeable, and you haven't approved those in the past. So with this, with what I know today, I would say, based on the board's past actions, I would recommend denial. The other thing, just to remind you all, I don't have the authority to deny a hardship. I can only approve hardships, which is why when there's denials or things that are fuzzy, that I bring them to the board. Are there any questions about this? I did ask, is there an event? I was trying to come up with what caused this. Was there some tragic thing that happened that caused the credit card debt? The member shared with me that basically the debt was incurred because he was supporting his adult child who was going through a difficult time. So a couple things we can deny this today and not do further, or I can continue to work with the member and delve into their, the next thing would be to go through all of their financial resources and determine if they have money to pay for these outside of getting the hardship request.
Kelly, you asked for more information. They didn't provide it. They didn't do the simplest of things. So
That's pretty clear to me.
Any other discussion?
A couple of things. One, thank you for doing this, and it's very educational. Two, philosophically, is the posture that everybody is a responsible individual, and so they get their benefit, they should be responsible with it, but if they prove to be irresponsible, then a last line of defense to make sure that your retirement is safe is that, generally speaking, our posture is denial, not approval, correct?
Our posture is to the board has taken the position of if something happens to you and you couldn't foresee it and it was unforeseen, you should have access to your drop money. The problem with these hardships, the thing that makes them most difficult in my mind when I'm looking at them is people with drop accounts had drop accounts and that was their savings. So the unforeseen part for a lot of them is the fact they don't have now access to that drop money. So if we hadn't annuitized the drop in 2017, they could pull the money out and pay for these things. But it was because of the law change in 17 they don't have access. So you could argue that's an unforeseen event. The board hasn't gone there because if everybody did that, that would, you know, over $1 billion would leave the plan, which would defeat the whole purpose. So it's very difficult.
The thing that pops in my mind is that I'm seeing like four court cases. You know, like usually with credit card and medical bills, you're given an opportunity to say, hey, I'm going to give you $25 a month. You know, that's what I can do. And to get to four court cases, there's some serious neglect there, in my opinion.
I mean, actually, isn't your pension benefit bankruptcy remote? So, you know, there's an argument that your solution is declare personal bankruptcy. Your pension benefit is protected.
Yeah.
To start over.
I mean, just like I said, you can't have everybody go get the drop money, then the pension will be gone.
Yeah, that was the concern why it became an unforeseeable thing was because we didn't want people creating their own crisis.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, I think this is, in my opinion, it's kind of cut and dry.
You know, the one thing I would say, though, is, and I guess I'm going to be an old saw on this, is I believe that this is another area for, or reason for an overall policy. Because, absent what you just said, Kelly, my thought would be that you're deny not to approve rather than you tell us to approve and not deny. But then understanding that the drop accounts were annuitized, so I essentially took your right to actually access your fund. I understand why it's now kind of an approval, you know, it's an affirmative power rather than a negative power. So I think it might be time to review the overall policy and see what we do and what we don't do, particularly after last week or last month. But I think I get it, and that's why I appreciate the explanation, but it's sort of another reason why I think a policy review is in order, because my knee-jerk reaction is the ED should not approve. But then when you understand the history, you go, I think I understand why there's a posture of approval rather than denial.
Okay. Yeah, I am happy to bring the policy back for a long time.
And again, I'm not picking one, and I'm not picking, but it's sort of like, you know, you're seeing around the edges that, to your point, it's been a while since a review, and there's some things where you go, that makes sense, that doesn't make sense. I think that doesn't make sense, but I'm only one voice out of 11, so it doesn't matter. But I think it's worthy of kind of reviewing things and having a conversation about them.
And I agree. I mean, the people around the table have changed since we put that in place, which is one of the reasons I brought this forward this way, is you all haven't had these conversations.
Excellent practice.
If we're going to review it, would it make sense to reach out to other organizations that have drop programs to see if they have standards of care or what kind of policies they've implemented? So we can utilize some of that perspective.
I definitely will look to see what others do. I'm not aware of anybody that has a drop. Most everybody has access to their drop, but I'll see. So it might be more defined distribution of what you said.
Okay.
We can see what others do.
Yeah.
Tom, I'm thinking we need an overall review. So, you know, not to create work for anybody, but it might take us but, you know, we take it a piece at a time, keep the elephant one bite at a time.
Fair enough.
Well, and I can tell you it's horrible to do the financial review. It's horrible to go through all their credit card stuff and their tax stuff, and they get very angry about it.
Sure. Yeah.
And I mean, we're trying to figure out their cash flow and as well as their assets and their liabilities, and it was a very difficult conversation.
Mm-hmm. Particularly when you took something that belonged to them. Mm-hmm. I get it. Thank you.
Any other questions? So if we get a motion to deny the hardship request?
Good motion.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Portfolio?
Morning, everyone. We announced it a couple weeks ago, but unfortunately tomorrow is going to be Christina's last day here at DPFP, so we just wanted to thank her for her service over multiple stints at the pension fund. She's been nothing but a pleasure to work with.
Lock the doors.
Yeah, stuck up here now. And she's been hard at work the last couple of weeks getting the KKR fund across the finish line, and so we appreciate everything, Christina. We'll miss you. Jumping into the update, so year-to-date through mid-year, the overall portfolio was up 7.3%. The public portion is up.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. We're sorry to see you go, but we understand, and I hope you understand when we lock the doors.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. Well deserved. 9.4% up on the public portfolio, which is now 80% of the assets. As I mentioned, we just got the KKR legal review completed and a doc signed for that for the 6:30 closing. We don't expect money to be called there until Q1, given the nature of the fund. The next up is working on the call of legal review that's underway. Closing for that fund is 9:30. On the multi-asset credit search, we plan to bring two finalists in 2 weeks from today to present to the IAC, and then they'll bring a recommendation back to the board in August on that front. I'll cover a bit more detail when we get to the asset allocation, but we continue to monitor the portfolio for rebalancing opportunities as they come up. So investment initiatives, I'm looking forward to the multi-asset credit search we talked about. Next up on the private market front is review of the secondary private equity funds and additional private credit investments. The board had some very good questions on the public equity portfolio last month, so we plan to kind of work those through with the IAC over the next few quarters and bring some recommendations back to you all, and then a potential value search later in Q4 into Q1. So it would be a good point to kind of just look at asset class returns, this periodic table chart, kind of mid-year. What you see there is international EM equity are leading the way up 20% and 15.5% respectively. The large cap, the kind of light green box in the middle, is the U.S. large cap up 6.2%. So a bit of rotation, as we talked about, between U.S., which has been leading the way, and international markets. And a lot of that's driven by the weakness in the dollar. I'll come back to the performance snapshot at the end. So mid-year update, we're up $144 million in investment gain.
Hey, Ryan.
Yeah.
I apologize. As I look at it, this is a great chart, the asset class.
Yeah.
If you were to run another chart underneath this, kind of the whole conversation of good bank, bad bank that we had last meeting, what would that look like? Because if you've got a 500-pound weight of bad assets, asset allocation is going to lag. And so are we seeing part of that recovery and increase in the asset allocation performance being the fact that you guys worked down kind of the bad bank balance, or is there something else behind?
No, so this chart is not totally clear. Asset allocation, that's not DPFE. That's just like a broadly diversified asset allocation. This is a J.P. Morgan chart.
Okay.
Assuming you're diversified. Our returns, we have some charts that show like our 10-year return, that too right now, as some of those returns from 15 and 16 write-downs drop off, like even at zero return the next 6 quarters, our 10-year trailing return is going to jump up quite a bit because we're dropping off some bad quarters with the significant write-downs we took, 15 and 16. So we've tried to be, you know, given some of the review from the city, be more cognizant of understanding kind of what's leading into that 5 and 10-year return stream and what the breakout of returns from the public portfolio is as compared to the private market.
So we do have that chart, and we've shared that with the city, sort of the, hey, before you evaluate overall performance, you need to understand that there was a weight on our belt for a good half of the evaluation.
We tried lots of times to communicate that, but I think it may be helpful to bring a few of those charts into here just so you guys can look at some of the stuff we had talked about with them maybe next month.
Thank you.
So we ended the month at $2.088 billion in assets, up $144 million on the investment side, down a net $40 from benefit outflows. On the safety reserve, we're just a bit below target here, but plenty of liquid assets in cash and short-term bonds, $170 million. That's enough to cover monthly outflows through August 27. We have some expected proceeds coming in from a sale that we'll talk about a bit on the private equity side that should replenish cash as those come in. So on the asset allocation page, if you look at the public equity line, we're at 58% compared to the target of 58%. I think it's probably the first time in over a decade that we've been fully to target in public equity assets. So we've been kind of, as private markets come back, adding to that over time and the growth in the markets plus some contributions we made the last couple of years. We're finally to that point. There's a little bit of rebalancing to do between Boston Partners and WCM, the two managers that have been kind of on a tear this year. And we'll probably look to add some money into the passive ACWI account later this month. But it's nice to finally be to that target we've been working towards for so long. So I'm going to go back to the flash, talk through some managers, and talk a little bit about Eastern Shore. So if you look at kind of top line, this is how we compare our public portfolio to 60-40. So over 3 and 5 year period, we're exceeding by quite a bit. Public equity portfolio outperforming in the near term, lagging a little bit on the 3 and 5 year returns. Boston Partners, which is our deepest value manager and has more European and mid-cap exposure than the other three managers, is up 24% over the 1 year period. WCM, which is our most recent hire in the equity portfolio and our higher growth manager, is up 32, doubling the growth benchmark on the 1 year. The two managers that are struggling are Manulife and Walter Scott. They have a bit more of a quality, a bit more core and a quality bias, so continue to monitor those two managers as we move forward. I'm going to come back to Eastern Shore once I look at the fixed income page here. So our core fixed income, all green, outperforming over all time periods of good there. Public credit, which is our bank loan, high yield, and E&D debt, pretty good results, a little bit mixed on the near term, but as we talked about, that's a bit tougher benchmark to beat, and we're right at it on the 3 year, outperforming by a little bit on the 1 year. So Eastern Shore is our U.S. small cap manager. We hired them in 2021. I sent you guys a memo. It's also in the additional confidential materials yesterday to review. Their performance struggled a bit between 21 and 23, which led to some pretty significant outflows in AUM. So we've been monitoring them closely and talking internally about them for a year plus on their asset base level. And in talking to Makita recently, we've decided that we should look at alternatives there and potentially move that to a passive option. I think from a small cap perspective, I think it's one of the big items I want to look at as we do the public equity review. You haven't been paid for owning small cap for a very long time, and I think it's fair to ask if that return premium is still there on a go forward. But as we go through that study, I think we should maintain exposure to small cap until we kind of make those decisions with IAC and work through that discussion. So the motion that we've proposed allows us to move assets into a passive option with the approval of Tom and Makita. And there's still a few things to work out on kind of the best passive option if, you know, when and how to transition. So any questions on that recommendation?
Are you going to make a distinction between value versus growth?
No, we would just go to a core Russell 2000. Eastern Shore, they have a little bit of a growth bias, but they're a pretty core manager overall.
Ryan, I'm not reading the chart properly, I guess, so if you could walk me through it. So I'm looking at the Russell 2000 index.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that's the right benchmark, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I look at Eastern Shore's performance, and so, you know, they're basically beating the benchmark. So I'm trying to figure out, is it a portfolio construction issue? Is it a manager selection issue? Is it a benchmarking issue? Because it's sort of like, hey, you know, I'm playing 500 baseball, but I'm about to get traded or sent down to the minors. And so can you help me understand how I'm not interpreting?
No, it's a totally fair question. They've done really well over the last year. It's less of a performance issue and more of a overall AUM of the firm has dropped from above $1 billion to $550 million, or more than 10% of their assets. So that's where the concern's coming from.
Yeah. I see. I gotcha.
What's AUM change?
It was over $1 billion when we hired them, and they were kind of a growth trajectory. And we knew they had some underperformance that we came in after when we funded them, but that's really bled into the longer-term numbers, and it's been difficult for them to raise new assets, and they've lost quite a bit. So right now it's 560.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Firm-wide asset is like 530, but for this product, it's just barely above 500.
So,
yeah.
We have a policy of not being more than 10%.
We don't, me and Tom talked about this yesterday. It's kind of a rule of thumb to monitor. We don't have a hard policy item on that. That may be something we want to add next time we reopen.
Very valid policy to have, and a lot of plans have it.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
So I think that's something we will prioritize. We have it on the private market side where if we're committing to a private market fund, we're not going to be more than 10% of the fund, so we don't get into a Lone Star situation where we're, you know, the majority investor in a fund. But we haven't had it on the public side before.
I know Houston Muni definitely has that.
Okay.
Sure. They definitely have it.
Ryan, and this is an unfair question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think that their inability to raise capital is based on underperformance, based on management issues, or do you think it's that kind of secular movement from active managed to passive managed?
If I could answer part of it, I think they're in a position where they're more challenged today than they have been historically, which has all kinds of implications.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if it's you're going to see more of this, which is just, hey, you know, it's good performance, but I can get the same or close performance at a lower cost, and so it migrates to a passive and you're pushing water uphill.
Yeah, and that's why the language of the motion is, if appropriate, you know, defer to staff to move accordingly.
Do you think we're going to see more of this?
Anything is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think flows have probably generally been away from unfortunately, the areas that are out of favor, small cap, EM, international, you know. I think we need to look at kind of mean reversion, where we expected and where we may not, given some market changes.
Yeah, I think we want to be more proactive, bottom line. Yeah, we don't want to have to react.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this makes sense. Thank you.
To that subject, two questions, Ryan. Are these comparisons, are these all net of fees?
Yes.
And then what's our industrial logic, if you will, about sort of global orientation in our equity funds versus domestic orientation? What's the driver there? It looks like most of these funds are global funds.
So we've had a global approach since I started. So prior to 2012, more people have moved that way, you know, and we were pretty early on kind of taking a global approach on the public equity side. We like the flexibility to give the managers discretion to decide what stock they like the best and in what geographies, so they can go overweight or underweight U.S., like Boston Partners has done. We don't quite have the flexibility from the staff level to pull those levers back and forth. So we think that's better, you know, left with the manager to make those decisions. I think the alternative approach would be kind of given it's harder to outperform in the U.S., just to index U.S. and go international, which more people have, I think, done recently. So, but overall, the global approach of work, what we split out was when we did the small cap additions, kind of coming out of McKee getting hired into reviews of the equity portfolio in 19 and 20, where you kind of need geographical specialists in small cap, and it made more sense to split out small cap into U.S. and international. So that's the only area where we have a international U.S. manager. The other four are global managers.
So if Scott Burns or Charlie Munger or Warren Buffett were sitting here, they'd say, I think, how does this performance compare if we had plunked all of our public equities into an S&P passive index fund in 2015? Do we ever do that comparison to see how we would have fared?
We would have underperformed for sure. The U.S. has outperformed for a long period now. It's rotating a bit. So I think there's, we prefer to be globally diversified, but that decision hasn't worked out, over this period. The U.S. is 63% of the equity, so it's not like we have a very healthy share in the U.S. But I think to me the question is more on a global equity portfolio. Where do you go passive? Where do you go active? What makes sense from that standpoint? I think we'd be, it would have worked out. We would be a pretty big outlier if we had no international equity exposure at all. Leo, are you on the line?
Yes, Ryan.
Yes, good morning.
Very loud this morning, Leo. do you hear that last question? And just kind of any thoughts on our global approach to public equity?
Yes. So, can you hear an echo?
Hear an echo or
no.
It's not echoing.
Okay.
The global construction is one that is very comfortable with. In fact,
when we have full discretion of accounting, our OCIO platform, that's what we employ. It's very similar to DPFPs. We came to work with you all starting in 2018, and it just so happens that it pretty much matches the way we prefer to allocate a global equity mandate. And that is composed, again, of a number of core strategies supplemented by completion strategies, which could be, in your case, small cap. You have two, and the question earlier came up. And the universe for global small cap is much more limited. So when we split it into domestic and international or non-US, we had a much larger set of universe to choose from. The only thing that is different between our traditional OCIO composite and yours is the use of index funds. In your case, you have one master ACWI IMI, so one position that essentially provides exposure across the whole global equity investment universe, whereas we break it out into each subcomponent, growth, value, small, large, U.S., non-China, ex-China, EM, et cetera, so that we can make tactical allocations. But that works because we can change it on a daily basis. In your case, with your set of meetings and with the board retaining ultimate authority, is not really conducive. So overall, we are very aligned, and I can tell you that the way you invest in global equities is the one we would do it if we had full discretion. There was another question that was raised earlier in terms of challenges to raising capital by Eastern Shore, and the amount of searches that have taken place in the small cap has been very limited. It has been a space that has been out of favor. Performance for the manager, while it's strong in the last 12 to 18 months, has been very weak. For example, between 2020 and 2023, they underperformed in 3 or 4 years by pretty large margins. And so when you look at 5 and 10 year numbers, deeply pretty much at the bottom or near the bottom. And so it's going to take a while for those numbers to roll off and to, trend median or better. And in addition, they had turnover, and the key person that was in charge of handling client accounts and, you know, being proactive in trying to bring new accounts, resigned less than a year ago. So to my knowledge, you know, that also kind of makes it more challenging to bring somebody that is good at a firm with assets that are coming down with some long-term performance struggle. So all of those things together, I think it's going to be more of a challenge for them to, you know, bring lots of new assets and take them over $1 billion. That's not going to happen anytime soon.
Thanks, Eyal. So on the kind of public equity review we plan to discuss with IAC, the main questions I'm hearing are kind of small cap, what to do there, our EM equity exposure, how do we want to access that, active versus passive, and then just the global approach to public equities, and if there's alternatives we should look at there. Is there anything else that you guys feel like I'm missing on that front?
You know, given that you've kind of cleaned up a bad bank, Ryan, over time, the other thing is you may want to revisit kind of your hedge fund and alts perspective in terms of kind of where it fits within portfolio construction and why.
Because I
think you're on much better footing now than you have been.
Yeah. We've done on the private market side. We haven't really looked at kind of risk mitigating or hedge funds, but we'll discuss that and figure out if there's a room there on a go forward.
Personally, I don't like them, but I understand what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I think we have to take a hard look.
Yeah, I mean, we had allocation in 12 to 16 to, it was Bridgewater, some GTAA, some tactical allocation, and that really struggled, and it was pretty high fee, so that got cut pretty quick when the new board came in. That's kind of our last exposure on that front that we've had.
We haven't been in a position to run.
Yeah, no, it's...
The existing portfolio has been a hedge on challenges.
So, yeah, no, exactly.
That's been our alternative.
Yeah.
You know,
all right, so if there's no other questions, we'll, John, he pulled the motion on Eastern Shore. Read it if you want.
Yes, so... We get a motion to authorize the staff with approval of KEDA and the chair of the Investment Advisory Committee to reduce the DPFP investment in Eastern Shore to any level staff deems appropriate and invest the proceeds of any such reduction temporarily in a passive small passive strategy.
I so move.
Sorry. Second. All right. All in favor?
All right.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Motion passes.
Thank you.
So we'll go in a closed session for the next 3 minutes.